I think it's a really, really important question. Remote supervision is such a buzzword at the moment, and certainly it's something that I think can work, but something that shouldn't be exploited. I think if you're seeing patients face to face, or you want a prescribing trainee to see patients face to face, you need to do it face to face, and you need to supervise that face to face, because you're not going to learn about those soft skills. You're not going to learn about those physical assessment skills, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But in terms of remote supervision, I'll give you an example.
Hi everyone, my name is Rahina Kassam and I am the CEO of Clinical Pharmacist Solutions and lead independent prescribing pharmacist by background. Today we are introducing our new podcast series for DPP Connects, which is our brand new and novel DPP Finder service, which has been created due to the lack of availability and funding of DPPs in the UK. It's been created to match those who are struggling to find DPPs with a fully vetted, high-quality DPP. Since we started the DPP Connect service, we have met with a number of universities to ensure that our services meet the quality and standards to ensure an ethical and transparent service, which helps our pharmacy professionals to develop and progress. We identify that this is a novel service and there may be some questions or concerns, and we've heard these questions and concerns and we wanted to create a podcast to address some of these for assurance and peace of mind. As we have gone through and answered a number of questions, as a result, we wanted to share why this service is important and we wanted to address some of these questions with someone that works within a university environment and then make this information readily available to the public. Joining us for this podcast today is Danny Bartlett, who is the Quality Assurance Lead for DPPs for the Independent Prescribing course at the University of Brighton. Danny is also part of our team as our Quality Assurance and Governance Lead. Thank you for your time today, and please do leave a comment below or get in contact with us at www.dppconnect.co.uk if you have any questions or queries related to the service. Thank you. Hi, everyone, and welcome to our first podcast at DPP Connect. My name is Rahina Kassam, and today I'm joined with Danny Bartlett and Mahmoud Yusupov. Hi, both. I'll let you introduce yourself. So, Danny, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, so I'm a pharmacist prescriber, been a prescriber for about 5 or 6 years. I'm also the DPP QA lead for the University of Brighton Independent Prescribing course, and I work full-time as a primary care pharmacist.
Thank you, Danny. And hi, Mahmoud. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Hi, Rahina. I'm also a prescribing pharmacist, managing director for Clinical Pharmacist Solutions, and one of the founders for DPP Connect.
Thank you both for joining us today. So today we're going to be looking at the DPP service and how we can help to support pharmacists and questions that you may have. So thank you both for joining and we'll get straight into it. So tell us a little bit more about the DPP service and why it was created.
It all started a number of years ago when we had a number of students reaching out to us, asking us to find them a DPP urgently. And some of them lost their DPPs halfway through their training. Some of them couldn't even start. And that was because of the lack of a written agreement, the lack of transparency. And students did find it difficult to find the DPP and agree with them and with certain terms that the DPP will be there for them as a DPP for the duration of the training. In this occurrence, we helped one or two students, then we helped four or five students, and then it kept growing and growing. And we realized that there is a real need for somebody to step in and be that independent body to stay between the DPPs and the students and standardize the process, have written agreements in place, and make sure that there's clinical governance and quality assurance in place. Hence, we decided to start the service.
As well, one of the main things is really key to point out to people is we've got 42 ICBs in the country, and every ICB is going to work slightly differently to try and solve this problem. And actually, there's going to be cross ICB relationships that just aren't being formed here. So actually, there's a DPP shortage in every single one of those 42 places. Now, do we think those 42 places are doing exactly the same thing to try and mitigate that gap and that shortage of DPPs? Probably not. Definitely not, I would say. So actually, we do just need a service and we need it quickly. And that what my experience in the NHS is that we want to do things quickly, but there's so much red tape. And there's so much red tape in terms of the digital side of things. There's so much red tape in actually just the policy side of things and getting things off the ground. And actually what we wanted to do with this service is we wanted to make sure that we didn't make the legacy workforce, these pharmacists that are itching to become prescribers, they don't get left behind. We want to make sure they have a platform to find a DPP, because if we wait for a service to get developed in all 42 ICBs that does exactly what we're trying to do with the service, I don't think we'll get there in time. And next thing you'll know, we'll be next year, 25, 26, and getting newly qualified pharmacists as prescribers. And my biggest worry is that this legacy workforce will get forgotten about. And there won't be any DPPs for the legacy workforce to do their prescribing course because they'll be taken up by the pre-registration year pharmacists. So we need to do something quickly. And from an NHS point of view, it's not always feasible to do that.
Absolutely. So one of the pressing questions that we may have is why would clinicians pay to be trained or pay for a service to have a DPP?
I think it's a logistical thing, really. I think at the moment it's a wicked problem. I think there's lots of people that can't find a DPP. And when they do find a DPP, it's quite hard to convince that DPP to free up time or even be able to physically free up time in their practice to supervise someone. So I think it's a combination of the DPP needing funding for their backfill time and also some prospective prescribing trainees just need help finding a DPP. So I think it's a mixture of kind of sourcing, but then also funding that backfill for the DPP.
Absolutely. And there's no national or local programs at the moment that kind of target this, is there, or that you know of?
No, not that I'm aware of anymore. I think there used to be kind of pockets of individual funding that was allocated for DPPs or to fund DPPs, only certain ICBs across the country, but that funding's waned away. So now we're in a bit of a vacuum where we need more DPPs, but we've got less funding.
Yeah, so I think like all of this kind of contributed to pharmacists wanting to fund for a DPP themselves. And sometimes it can be seen as unethical if they do go by it themselves. So what's your take on pharmacists actually funding these places?
For me, I think that there's a balance to be struck. I think it has to be a logistical funding and not making profits from extorting the profession. I think we all need to make sure we're aware of the costs associated with backfill time. So if I'm released from a clinic one session a week, for example, that's going to cost the practices and the PCM money. So there is a cost associated with that. I don't think that's a dirty word. I think that that's just a logistical thing. But what we've seen, I think, with this vacuum of funding that I alluded to is we've seen people extorting pharmacists and charging huge amounts of money to be their DPP without any quality assurance. And we're now actually knowing that that's going to be a quality amount of supervision that they're going to get. And that's what I think I'm really kind of morally against.
Absolutely. And it is a big pitfall at the moment with actually wanting to be able to pay for a DPP and having that funding there, but it can be seen as unethical because it may be seen as you're actually paying to be signed off really to actually complete your portfolio and your IP. What is your take on that?
I think it's something that we are very clear with is that the funding does not mean you have to sign a student off. And I think that that's something that definitely all three of us are very passionate about kind of making clear. Certainly from my university perspective, if I heard that a DPP was signing someone off just because they felt guilty because they were committing this time to a student, that's not appropriate and that student wouldn't pass with me. So long as there's that quality assurance and also that agreement indelibly with the DPP that you don't sign that student off until you are comfortable with it and you feel that that student has met all of the learning outcomes. And I think that that is our line in the sand and that should be the line in the sand for any DPP really.
Yeah, and that's why we need a third party between the student and the DPP to connect them and also hold that deposit, so to say, and release that as soon as the 90 hours have been completed, regardless whether the student is signed off as competent or not. And that will remove that conflict of interest.
Absolutely, I agree. And it helps to keep the service ethical as well. So good quality students that have completed the 90 hours of learning in practice get through the process as well. So given all of that, how do we ascertain that the DPPs actually as part of the service are to a good standard and how will they support the student?
So that's why I'm on board. The process that I developed at the University of Brighton, it was definitely something that wasn't happening nationwide. I think that DPPs weren't being scrutinised enough, I guess is the phrase to use. But when we got reaccredited for our course by the GPHC, they actually picked this particular model that I developed out as an outstanding bit of QA, really, for that DPP. And that was one of the key mechanisms for me wanting to share that, is actually every course should have this approach. Everything to do with DPPs need to have a closer eye on it. We need to make sure the people that are putting themselves down to be that designated prescribing practitioner are appropriate supervisors, know what they're getting themselves in for, know exactly what is going to be asked of them, know exactly what they should be doing when a student gets into trouble, or if a student gets into trouble, I would say, but also has the expertise to be able to lean a student in difficulty on the straight and narrow, and being able to be competent and, as Mahmood said, to be non-judgmental and to only sign people off when they're absolutely competent and not to sign people off for any other external pressure reasons.
Absolutely. So this leads to a few questions about the actual DPP and the learning and practice period. So although we have agreements in place with the DPP, sometimes the wider practice team may not know of these agreements. How can we make sure that the practice team are aware that the student will be with them and having their training done there?
I think it's really important. All practices work slightly differently to one another. And the main key factor and overriding factor of importance to practices is information governance. And they need to make sure that whoever is accessing their services and their patients is treating the data confidentially. So we make sure that every practice has a confidentiality agreement signed by the prospective prescribing student before any clinical work starts. And not only does that help the student know exactly what tramlines to work within, but also it means that the practice is then aware that they've got a trainee working. What that setup will be like will be different trainee to trainee. So you might have a trainee doing some in-person clinics, some remote clinics, but at least through that agreement kind of taking place before the student starts, that's almost a contract, not only of the data, but a contract of how that student is going to be working with that organisation.
Absolutely. So I think with DPPs, DMPs, they can generally be very busy throughout the day, so they may not have time to actually mention it to the practice manager. So once we've signed that confidentiality agreement, it just makes sure that the practice manager is aware, and it kind of helps that seamless process to occur in terms of setting up smart cards, letting the rest of the team know. So it gives a nicer feel to the service for the student that is then joining. So touching on that, as we said, DPPs, DMPs can be very busy a lot of the time. They may not be able to spend all of their time with the student. Therefore, all of their hours may not be with the student. How would we account for this?
I think so. Every prescribing course in the country is 90 hours specified prescribing supervision, 45 of which has to be with the DPP, and the other 45 has to be with another prescriber. So just as I said, different students are going to have different models for training and supervision. They're going to potentially need exposure to different professionals. So if you're doing, for example, a scope in respiratory, you might want to sit in with a prescribing asthma nurse or a pharmacist, perhaps with a specialised interest. And I think that's a conversation right at the beginning of the journey between the DPP and the student, is exactly what types of hours the DPP as the supervisor feels is appropriate for that student, but also what the student wants exposure to as well. Maybe perhaps that's something that is a continued dialogue, and that's what I expect with my university hat, and that's what I expect the student to do. We're not going to spoon feed everyone. We want the student to think, oh, actually, that was really useful sitting in with that paramedic practitioner, but maybe I need to sit in with the asthma prescribing nurse a bit more to gain a bit more knowledge about inhaler technique and escalation of treatment. So I think, yeah, the different models of supervision and the different roles will vary student to student, but what's really, really essential for us is that we've got a good quality DPP that is aware on how to move around those hours and make those hours work for the student, but also work for them, so they're not tied to a particular student all of the time, because that's burdensome and that's not going to be kind of conducive to good supervision.
Absolutely. So with nurses, when they do their prescribing, they often have a DSP in place. What do you think of that model of working?
I think it's good. I think it's a good idea, particularly for DPPs that are really busy and actually struggle with the logistical arrangements of supervision. And I think that having someone as an overarching supervisor that can then look at the model of supervision and think, right, okay, we've got 90 hours to meet. We've met the 45 of the DPP. You want to learn a bit more about X, Y, and Z, and this is what we're going to kind of organize and arrange for you. And I think that having that second person with more of a strategic view over the supervision is really, really useful.
Absolutely. So As we mentioned previously, there are different models of supervision, and some of these may be remote. So how do we manage remote supervision and make sure that it is quality assured, especially when patients actually are being seen face to face?
I think that's a really, really important question. Remote supervision is such a buzzword at the moment, and certainly it's something that I think can work, but something that shouldn't be exploited. I think if you're seeing patients face to face, or you want a prescribing trainee to see patients face to face, you need to do it face to face, and you need to supervise that face to face, because you're not going to learn about those soft skills. You're not going to learn about those physical assessment skills, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But in terms of remote supervision, I'll give you an example, because I'm DPP at the moment for one of my pharmacists, and her scope is lipids. And actually, rather than me and her hunched over a single laptop screen trying to look at bloods of a particular patient, me going on a Teams call with her, directly sharing my screen on system one and having an HD view myself, and her having an HD view herself, and then also having the ability to listen to soft phone recordings of her phone consultations. There's no difference between me sitting next to her with a headset hunched over a screen. If anything, it's probably better me having a big screen and us not being so close together, particularly as it's moving into summer and it's absolutely roasting every day. So I think remote supervision can work in a variety of different settings for a variety of different scopes. But again, it comes back to, it's that discussion between the DPP and the trainee. It comes back to that nuanced relationship, but also that nuanced agreement between the supervisor and the trainee of what exactly they need to achieve all of the learning outcomes for that particular course.
The way I look at it is if the care is being provided remotely, then remote supervision is appropriate. Whereas if the care to the patient is provided in person, then you really have to think how you're going to accommodate remote supervision. But nowadays, a lot of clinics run remotely, and in which case, then remote supervision becomes suitable.
I agree.
Absolutely. So, as you just mentioned, Danny, we touched on physical assessment skills. And how would we be assessing those in a remote situation?
Absolutely. So I think it depends on what the scope is. It depends on what physical assessment skills we need. So quite a lot of the prescribing courses, I think it's important to point out, is quite a lot of the prescribing courses, including my own, have a dedicated lecture and workshop to physical assessment skills. So actually learning those physical assessment skills is probably more geared and tailored towards actually the independent prescribing course that the trainee is on. But actually, when we're moving towards how do they practice that in real practice, it's going to depend. So the majority of my blood pressure patients will have home blood pressure monitoring or ABP, and actually a prescribing trainee might not necessarily need to take a manual blood pressure every single time. But if I want someone to be competent in hypertension, I would want them to come in and practice doing a manual blood pressure. But they wouldn't have to do it in every single supervision session. I just want to make sure that I'm signing them as competent, perhaps once or twice within that 90 hours supervision with a different patient each time. So I think it does vary. Now, if you've got someone that's got a respiratory scope, of course they need to listen to chest sounds and things like that. And they need to make sure that they're used to doing that physical assessment skill. So they'll need much more of a hands-on, face-to-face supervision model. I think it really depends, and that learning plan, it comes back to it. I sound like a bit of a broken record, but it comes down to that agreement between the DPP and the student of what their scope is, what their learning outcomes they need to achieve are, and exactly what type of supervision model needs to be addressed there.
Perfect. Thank you, Danny. So, in terms of the scope of practice, how do we make sure the DPP's scope aligns to the student's scope of practice?
Again, so such a good question, and something that I almost think we've given too much power to the prescribing trainees, and actually the scope should be determined by the designated prescribing practitioner. So if we look at NHS England's new standards, if you like, for pre-reg trainees or foundation year pharmacists that are coming out, and they're going to be independent prescribing trainees in their pre-registration year, right? And actually the NHS England guidance says that they have to work and meet the competencies within a prescribing area that is aligned to their supervisor. So that should be, in my mind, that should be exactly the same for a prescribing course in a postgraduate setting. Is actually, who is the type of patient that your DPP encounters on a daily basis? How many patients with blood pressure do they see on a daily basis? They see loads? Fantastic. Well, then your scope should be blood pressure and cardiovascular disease. You shouldn't really come to a look for a DPP with a really tiny niche scope where you're not going to get exposure to the patients. So I think dictated for me by the DPP and not by the student. Now, my particular disease area that I'm interested in is Parkinson's disease. But if I was to put Parkinson's disease as my specified scope in general practice, probably only going to speak to one or two patients with Parkinson's disease in a week, so I'm not going to meet my 90 hours of supervision for that scope. Certainly, my DPP isn't going to feel comfortable ticking me off and signing me off in all of Parkinson's disease if I only see two patients a week. Whereas, how many patients do I see on a daily basis with cardiovascular disease? How many patients do I see with asthma and COPD? Loads. So actually, maybe that's more of an appropriate scope. So I do think we need to change the narrative slightly. And actually, the prescribing trainee is not in power to choose their scope unless it's definitely something that they're going to encounter with that particular DPP. Now, after they've qualified as an independent prescriber, they've been signed off by their DPP, and perhaps they want to go and further their learning and go and do a course on Parkinson's disease and maybe further their learning and broaden their scope that way. That's the best order to do it in. And I think that I never really hear that from quite a lot of organizations. And I think we need to be the champions of that. And we need to make sure that when we are getting DPPs within our service for all of these prescribing trainees, we need to empower the DPPs to actually go to their trainees and say, well, these are the patients that I see on a daily basis. This is the scope that we should address here.
So I wholeheartedly agree with what you've just said there, Danny. I think it can sometimes be counterproductive when students have a very narrow scope and we're putting them into a general practice setting where a GP, DPP, DMP may not necessarily see those patients often. I think one of the nice things about our service is actually all of our GPs are familiarized with most of the long-term chronic conditions, as they're the things that they see day in, day out. So things like asthma, COPD, hypertension, and sometimes they are familiar with diabetes, sometimes they're not. So we like to show what the DPP's kind of scope of practice is. If there is something that is more niche, something like dermatology or looking at a specific area of dermatology, we are quite clear with what that might be for some of our DPPs. So I completely agree. It should be dictated by what the DPP can do, because it can lead to some high expectations, which you may not necessarily get a full 90 hours of seeing. And then your portfolio doesn't necessarily match what you have in your learning and practice. Moving on from that, how does a trainee raise a concern? So what processes are in place to deal with concerns? Or what would we do if a DPP had a concern about a student? How would we escalate?
So I think it's really important to point out what the model is at the moment and then how our model actually adds an extra layer to that, an extra layer of help I see it as. So at the moment, if I put my university hat back on, if there is a DPP that's raising a concern or a student that's raising a concern, their first port of call would be me at the university. And actually, that might be quite difficult for them. It might be quite difficult, particularly with my university role. I'm only working one day a week at university, so that concern might be kind of not necessarily addressed as quickly as someone working 5 days a week. So I have my clinical role as well. But with our service, we've got this added layer where actually the first issue or concern is raised directly to us, to the DPP service. And then we then determine whether that is an issue that then needs to get escalated to the university and the higher education institute, or actually if it's an issue that we can kind of sort out as a service, because we're providing that service. We initiated that relationship between the DPP and the trainee, and actually we fostered that. So it's incumbent on us to make sure that that relationship is good. Whereas actually universities, they don't have any part in that relationship between a DPP and a trainee to start with. They weren't the ones that linked them together. So actually they're coming into it cold without a huge amount of knowledge, whereas we're in a better spot because we know exactly what the DPP is like. We've probably used them before. We know exactly what their scope of practice is like. And perhaps we even know the trainee as well. And actually, I think that will really, really help us not only kind of solve problems quicker, but also be that first port of call in a much more efficient way.
Absolutely. And for this reason, we have our own in-house training coordinator who would be able to deal with that relationship, help to deal with any concerns and escalate where appropriate. So we are trying to help foster a really positive environment for the DPP and for the student. So moving on from DPP style concerns and questions, in terms of community pharmacists, a lot of community pharmacists want to find DPPs, but they wouldn't really have a clue of what to do in primary care. We've all been there. We all start somewhere. All of our DPPs are in primary care. How do we ensure that they can actually make use of the 90 hours of learning and practice?
Again, I think this is definitely a vacuum. And I think that quite a lot of the students that apply to my prescribing course at Brighton come from a community pharmacy background, and their first couple of weeks of hours are spent almost trying to upskill themselves on what the surgery system is, what are the processes, actually what's it like to sit down instead of be on your feet all day in a pharmacy, and actually this is quite nice, my cup of tea and coffee is hot instead of freezing cold. But actually, that orientation is so, so important to almost do that beforehand. And I think through this service, we offer the training to enable them to look at a surgery computer system like System 1 and EMIS, to have a look at, before they start any of their 90 hours, to have a look at what those systems look like, how to read a blood test, what types of communications come in, how to send a task, how to record a consultation with a patient, and how that differs to a community pharmacy setting. And actually giving them a head start is so, so important. And I actually think it's so vital. It's something that I use when I teach the undergraduates, because they go out on placements and clinical placements to general practice, and I don't want them going to general practice on a 2-week placement without knowing anything and a baptism of fire occurring. So actually I take my laptop in from the surgery into the lecture theatre, plug the HDMI in and show them what System 1 and EMIS are like. And this is the service that we offer. We offer almost a bit of a preview of what to expect. And I think that's really, really important. It means they can hit the ground running, but also means they get the most out of their DPP and they come out as a better prescriber because of that.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen from the students that we've helped through the service so far, those that actually complete the training, go in with the EMIS and System 1 knowledge, seem to have a really good outcome in their learning and practice hours and go on to really enjoy it, because from day one, they can hit the ground running. So it not only teaches them EMIS and System 1 training, it teaches them what good looks like in general practice. What do you do if you've tried to contact a patient 3 times? How do you record this in the consultations? Not just that, it's how to structure a consultation, like the golden minute when you're consulting with a patient, and to type up the consultations. Because as simple as these skills may sound, it just does take a little while to get used to it on a GP practice software. So moving on from that, Danny, does a DPP have to be a prescriber 3 years? We hear a lot around this area at the moment, and it is kind of the hot question that a lot of people are asking.
Absolutely. So I can concretely say that absolutely not does the DPP have to be a prescriber for 3 years. That is something that was taken from the RPS designated prescribing practitioner framework, and it's a recommendation. It's actually, it would be recommended that they had been prescribing for roughly 3 years. And actually, if you think about it, I've got a newly qualified prescriber. She sees about 50 patients a day. She works in cardiovascular disease and all of the other areas of general practice. And would I be happy for her to be a DPP in the next 6 months to a year? Absolutely. But she hasn't met that technical threshold. So the GPHC have specified to me directly, and I know that that is something that they've communicated to all of the universities, that it's not a recommendation tied to the GPHC reaccreditation. Now, certain universities may have stipulated that they need a DPP to have been a prescriber for 3 years, but that is not associated with any formal recommendation from the GPHC. So if a university does have that recommendation within their kind of entry criteria, I would still encourage any prescribing trainee with a DPP that has potentially got a DPP that has only been qualified for 2 years, for example, to still apply. That isn't a rate limiting factor. What is really important is the quality of that DPP, because we need to make sure all of the things we've covered already, that DPP is an appropriate DPP to supervise that trainee. So it's a myth. It's a really frustrating myth that we need to debunk. And you can see why universities did it, because they got their degree, or their course rather, reaccredited with that stipulation within it. But I have been told concretely by the GPHC that this is not a recommendation from the GPHC. It's not going to have any bearing on them not getting reaccredited or removing the reaccreditation. And I'm told that that is a generalized communication that will be coming out from the GPHC.
Thank you, Danny. I think this is a question that we get a lot, and there are a lot of excellent IP pharmacists out there that are ready to support pharmacists and help the profession grow and develop. So I think that will be some really great advice and guidance for them.
And similarly, I think the 3-year mark doesn't necessarily mean that the prescriber is suitable to be a DPP. You may have a prescriber who has been prescribing for the last 3 years and been qualified for 3 years, but they may have been rarely using their qualification and making prescribing decisions. So you may have a DPP or potential DPP who had been a prescriber for 18 years.
Never prescribed a single prescription. Yeah, did the course and then never prescribed it. It's for me, it's the equivalent of saying a DPP has to be 6 foot tall. Anyone under 6 foot tall can't be a DPP. It's just it's a metric that we shouldn't be using. I think we need to make sure that every university and every course screens every single DPP with scrutiny and actually asks the questions that we've gone through today. That should be it. That should be the carte blanche, should be every university is incumbent to screen those DPPs, just like we screen the DPPs in our service. Now, do I think it happens in variation across the courses? Absolutely. So I think standardizing it and saying, making sure that every university has that process in place is paramount. Putting a particular number on years qualified as a prescriber, I just don't think is really important.
Absolutely. And as you just mentioned, Danny, an important part of our service. So we do screen our DPPs just to make sure that there is a good quality DPP there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the quality assurance processes that we have behind that?
Totally. So the process that I developed for the University of Brighton prescribing course, it's certainly something that when we've had meetings or when I've had meetings with DPPs halfway through this cohort that we've got, and I ask them the question, did you find that initial screening kind of useful? Did you find it beneficial to have a chat to talk about what are the expectations and go through the process of making sure that you're the appropriate fit for that trainee? And the resounding feedback was absolutely yes. So the types of questions that we ask are you an active prescriber? Have you taken a prescribing trainee before? What would you do if a trainee got into difficulty? We ask them questions. Are you aware of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society DPP competency framework? Do you feel that the learning environment is adequate for a trainee pharmacist? Are there any barriers to taking this trainee on? Will you ensure that there is a minimum of 90 hours of supervised practice and a minimum of 45 hours with yourself? And then also, will you make sure that you raise concerns if you do have them? And then also, we ask things like, what is the active scope of practice in your role? Do you have any other active supervision needs for other trainees? So is it EP, for example, that has three other ST3s they're supervising? Because I think that's really important, because if you've got someone that is supervising five or six other people, do we really feel that they've got the capacity to take another trainee on? And I found that actually asking that question provokes a thought. We're all firefighting as clinicians, and actually some people just do need to think, actually, that is maybe one step too far. Maybe I do need to draw this back a bit. Maybe I can take a trainee on 6 months or so when I lose another trainee because they're qualified or something. So I think those types of QA processes is something that I would encourage every university to do. I definitely don't think it happens everywhere, certainly not the feedback I have from the GPHC. And I think with our service, having this exact same QA process just enables us to make sure that the DPPs, whatever university they're going to, in terms of the trainees rather, it's not just a Brighton process. This is a process that we've adopted as the service as well. And I think that's going to just breed better DPPs all round.
Perfect. So as we know, there is some Health Education England training for DPPs. What are we doing to promote that training?
We issued guidance on how to become a DPP for all healthcare professionals and published it on our website. And the first step that we recommend is complete the relevant ATE or NHS England funded training program. As part of our onboarding process, we enforce it on certain DPPs who haven't had enough qualification or enough experience to complete the training before they get on board with us.
So the link is on our website as well when you go to sign up. So link to the DPP Health Education England training. So back to another question for you, Danny. How do we assess the learning environment is adequate for a trainee prescriber as part of our service?
So I think it's going to vary on what that learning environment looks like. Like I said before, all practices are different and all models of supervision are going to be slightly nuanced trainee to trainee. I think my main key thing that I look for in asking that question is, have they had trainees before? Is it a collaborative working environment where not only they're going to be sat behind passively watching a screen without being able to interact with anyone? Is there actively some learning in that organization? So do they have other trainees that are there? Have they taken trainees before? Have they got a variety of different prescribers and clinicians that particular trainee can sit in with? You'll be amazed at how quickly you can gauge that. And actually, if you have someone that is actively in education or actively wants to get into education, is very passionate about it, you can get that straight away. A couple of sentences, they'll be like, oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've got a nurse trainee. We've got a PA trainee as well. We took a paramedic trainee for a couple of weeks. And actually, I've had two prescribing trainees come through this organization in the last couple of years. already you can already hear that they want to train more. They've got that. Now, the double-edged sword is, have they got capacity to take more trainees? So I think we make sure that learning environment is as enthusiastic and supportive, but we also make sure they're sustainable as well, because we don't want to put a trainee in a situation where they're fighting for that supervisional hours. And I think it's really important in terms of a learning environment to balance the two. It's hard. It's really hard to do that. But us putting that QA process in place makes sure that that trainee is going to a supportive and sustainable environment.
Absolutely. So thank you, Danny and Mahmood. It's been a really informative session. There's been some very difficult questions that we've answered here, but I think it's very reassuring with what the service can provide and the quality assurance that we have here. So whether you're a university with questions, whether you're a potential DPP that would like to join to support our students, or whether you're a pharmacist looking for a DPP to help support you on your independent prescribing course, please reach out to us or go to our website at www.dppconnect.co.uk. Thank you.